You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Keith Johnson, a reporter for American Free Press. On March 9th, 2013, New York Times journalists Mark Mazzetti, Charlie Savage, and Scott Shane penned a lengthy article that attempted to set the record straight concerning the 2011 extrajudicial assassination of the American-born Islamic cleric and alleged terrorist, got to put that in parentheses, terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki. The article, which is entitled How a U.S. Citizen Came to Be in America's Crosshairs, is supposedly, quote, based on interviews with three dozen current and former legal and counterterrorism officials and outside experts, unquote, and purports to fill, quote, indeed, new details of the legal, intelligence, and military challenges faced by the Obama administration in what proved to be a landmark episode in American history and law, unquote. Now, this article is a very Obama-friendly piece and just goes to show you, as far as I'm concerned, in my opinion, how far the New York Times will go to advance whatever war agenda the powers that be are currently pushing. Now, I touched on this topic last year in an article entitled A Megaphone for War Propaganda, where I gave several examples of this collusion, particularly that of a former New York Times reporter, Daniel Simpson, who went public during a September 19th interview with Russia Today, and he said, quote, it seemed glaringly obvious to me that all the news fit to print was pretty much the news to fit the powerful. When I was young, naive, and idealistic, I thought I was holding people in power to account. It turned out instead, when I joined in 2002, that the New York Times was very much engaged in doing what those in power wanted them to do by printing false intelligence information to start the war in Iraq, unquote. Now, while working for the Times, Simpson witnessed firsthand how the U.S. government looked for every possible way of getting this so-called weapons of mass destruction narrative into the news media, and found that America's paper of record to be a willing ally in manufacturing these false headlines. And in my article, I also pointed out that New York Times writer Jeremy W. Peters also admitted that his employer gives government officials and political candidates, quote, approval over statements attributed to them in the newspaper. Another example was New York Times national security and intelligence reporter Mark Mazzetti, who just happens to be a co-author in this piece that we'll be discussing shortly. He was exposed for conspiring with the same government entity that he's supposed to hold accountable. And according to the patriotic group Judicial Watch, the Central Intelligence Agency was concerned about an upcoming article by Times journalist, or columnist rather, Maureen Dowd, who is writing about the CIA's role in leaking information to Hollywood filmmakers about the alleged raid on Osama bin Laden. In emails obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, it was revealed that CIA spokeswoman Marie Harf reached out to Mazzetti and asked for any information about the upcoming piece. Within minutes, Mazzetti forwarded a draft of Dowd's unpublished piece to Harf. At the top of the email, Mazzetti wrote, "This didn't come from me, and please delete it after you read. See? Nothing to worry about." Well, folks, things haven't changed, and this recent New York Times article proves it. But instead of effectively making their case for the drone assassination of Mr. Awlaki, they actually verify what we've known all along, that in the twisted logic of the Obama administration, words are weapons, evidence is hearsay, or rather hearsay is evidence, and verdicts are handed down before a defendant really has an opportunity to tell their side of the story. That's the new America, folks. And this AFP reporter recently spoke with former CIA analyst and anti-war activist Ray McGovern. And I asked Mr. McGovern if he read the New York Times piece and if he agrees with me that this is further evidence of collusion between the nation's so-called newspaper of record and the current administration.
Yes. It's a very artful manipulation of public opinion. With all due credit to the authors, it reads like a Gresham novel, right? And it's as artful as a Leni Riefenstahl propaganda film under the Third Reich. It's very appealing. And when you look at it closely, you realize that it's a complete, what's the word? It's a complete reversal of the Bill of Rights, and specifically I refer to the Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not a trivial matter, but 50 years ago when I was commissioned as an officer of the United States Army, I took a solemn pledge, a solemn vow, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Mm-hmm.
That oath has no expiration date. And when I see functionaries of our government deliberately violating everyone's right, and let me just repeat what the Fifth Amendment says, no person. Now, why do you suppose our framers didn't say, oh, no U.S. citizen or no American? They chose to say, no person, okay? Quote, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I see people, functionaries like John Brennan and top functionary in chief, Barack Obama, asserting the right to execute people without due process of law, and defending that on grounds such as the chief law enforcement officer of our government, Eric Holder, and John Brennan, and others have said, well, due process? Oh, that doesn't mean judicial process. That just means we do due process right here in the U.S. Thank you very much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That is such a scandal. And why the legal profession, aside from some hardy souls, why the legal profession in this country is not up in arms about this is in itself a scandal. So what we have here is really an artful leaking. Now, here's another aspect of this thing. Scott Chain says, all Scott Chain and Mazzetti and Savage, the White House wouldn't talk to us. The White House, they wouldn't talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
But we did talk to 36, well, he says, three dozen other sources. Well, this is very sensitive information. Where are the, why is the Obama administration not moving smartly against people who leak this information as smartly as they have against seven bona fide whistleblowers who reveal some of the crimes that the Obama administration and before the Bush administration have become? Where are the leak investigations here? Well, these are guided leaks, of course, and I suppose what troubles me the most is the aura of sanctity here. At one point, it's mentioned in one of these little press reviews that I've been reading that the sanctity of life doesn't seem to be what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
These extrajudicial executions are very clearly in violation of the right to life. Now, John Brennan, in the first U.S. Times, quote, expose, end quote, of this type, was portrayed as a virtual priest to Barack Obama, Hal Ho, the top lawyer for the point, the top lawyer slash lawyer for the State Department, the top lawyer, said, you know, we all feel so comfortable that the last person that the president sees before he decides who to execute is John Brennan, because he has these values, he's Jesuit educated, and so forth. Well, you know, the Jesuit education, you know, right to life, that's, you know, the sanctity of life is a big thing in Catholic education, but as far as Brennan is concerned, at least, it seems to only apply to the first 9 months of life, and then once you're out of the womb, you're fair game.
It sounds like what was that comedian's name? George Carlin. Yeah, he says once you're 18 years old, you're fair game. Exactly, that is really good.
The other thing is, you know, Jesuits always had this philosophical principle of the double effect, okay? Mm. And that was that as long as you don't intentionally try to kill somebody, you're trying to kill somebody else who's worth killing. Then, you know, as long as you don't will it, that's okay. That's the definition of collateral damage.
Right.
This other American citizen, mm-hmm. Even Alaki's 16-year-old son, not 21, as the administration leaked to the beginning. He wasn't 21 years old, he was 16, all right? Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't want to kill him, they just did kill him, but it was collateral damage. Now, the other thing to remember here is that no dove he, Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, revealed just 3 weeks ago that an estimated 4,700 human beings have been killed by drones. Now, okay, 4,700. Where do you get that figure? Well, that happens to be the figure that the most respected British human rights organization has done by on-the-ground investigations in the drone-striking area of Pakistan in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do most people say? Well, how about they're terrorists? Well, the real information on this is that 2% of the people killed are terrorists. Okay, so I've done the math here.
Yeah.
The little mistake, all right? 2% of 4,700 people killed as a result of drone strikes amounts to 94 people. 94 people out of 4,700. Okay?
Right.
But, you know, except for those 94 people, they're not really intended to be killed. They're collateral damage, and it's really too bad. As Brennan explained on the 30th of April last year, it's unfortunate, but some people have to die because of this war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
It's very remarkable.
Yeah. You know,
when you look at the motivations behind the so-called terrorists, you know, the real ones, the ones that were caught trying to blow up the airliner on Christmas Eve 2008, okay? Abdul Muttalib is the fellow's name. I can pronounce it just as fluently as John Brennan, and I haven't had any real Arabic, okay? Abdul Muttalib gives certain kind of credence here. All right, what was he doing? Well, who was he? He was a high-class, upper-class, wealthy Nigerian. Okay, his father had a position in the World Bank or something like that, okay? He goes to Yemen, and what happens? Well, according to Brennan, he was, quote, self-radicalized, end quote. So I guess you watch your TV program, and they say, you know, I think I'll become a radical. I think I'll try to blow up a plane. Well, give me a break. That's not what happened at all. You know what happened in Yemen? And we know this for a fact. It happened right after the Israelis really destroyed lots of people in Gaza.
Right.
And it was that
gaslight
that turned him around and made him into a terrorist. Now, did Awlaki give him the bomb, the underpants bomb and all? You know, if that happened, I really think the administration owes us that evidence. And the evidence is, as usual, very elusive in all this kind of thing. So, you know, the whole thing stinks to high heaven. And what I come back to is a president who... Well, let's go back to when he was running for president. There was another constitutional issue. It had to do with illegal eavesdropping on American citizens. How did that happen? Well, Dick Cheney called the head of NSA, his name was Michael Hayden, later became head of the CIA, and said, you know that little commandment that you have there at NSA, thou shalt not eavesdrop on Americans without a warrant, that's out the door. After 9/11, everything changed. Will you convene a small coterie of people you can trust not to tell anybody and eavesdrop on all Americans? And we assure you we can get AT&T, Verizon, and the rest of the world to cooperate. Will you do it? Michael Hayden. Michael Hayden, another devout Catholic, all right? Now, what does he do with his confirmation? This is relevant here. When later he's up for confirmation a CIA director. Kit Bond serves him a softball pitch. Okay, he says, now, General Hayden, when the president asked you to eavesdrop on Americans without a warrant, did you have when you got a presidential order, did you have any reluctance, any hesitation there? And Hayden blew it. Instead of saying, of course not, President Kula, he said, well, Senator Bond, yes, I had to think long and hard about this decision, but in the end, I decided I could not do what the president asked me to do. Okay, now why is that relevant? Well, that's relevant because Senator Barack Obama condemned that accurately as unconstitutional a crime, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, what happened? Well, this fellow John Brennan started to go to work for Senator Obama when he was running for president. And what did Obama do? After having threatened not to vote for the legislation which held harmless AT&T and Verizon and all these criminals like Hayden, Cheney, and all the rest of them. It's a felony. It's a felony, right?
Yeah.
The fight the law was a felony. The FISA law, which required a fourth warrant to monitor conversations with American citizens, was a felony. That was put in place in 1978 after the atrocious things that the CIA and other people have been doing. So this is no small thing. These people are up on felony charges, and there's legislation introduced to excuse them, to hold them harmless. And what does Barack Obama do? He votes for that law. That was my first clue. That this guy is a malleable manager of the law. He's no constitutional scholar. He's a disgrace to the law, and he's, with respect to killing Americans, his pretense that this is somehow lawful prompts me to ask myself, what is my obligation? What is the obligation of not only me, but millions, literally millions of Americans, not only in the armed forces, but in the armed forces and in other high state and federal offices who take a solemn oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, as we watch things like the Fourth Amendment in the eavesdropping business, the Fifth Amendment in the extrajudicial killings. What is our obligation? Does it suffice for us to write op-eds and give interviews like this? I don't think so.
Right.
I think the time has come to get out in the streets and tell the president that he's not above the law, he's not King John, and 2 years from now, when we celebrate the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, which secured these rights for civilized people for the first time, okay? My question is, well, when we celebrate that anniversary, will it be an inquest? Will it be a funeral? Or will there be enough of us to get out in the streets, protest vehemently enough, so that we can celebrate the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta with dignity and with a feeling that we had honored those gutsy English barons who stood up to the king and said, no, no more. We want habeas corpus, and we don't want to be killed, and we don't want to be imprisoned without judicial process.
Well, yes, most certainly a revolution against this corrupt government that targets its own populations is well overdue, particularly when you consider the decisions as to whom will be killed are being made by a select few people. Among those select few are David Barron and Martin Lederman of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, who, according to the article, quote, concluded, based on the evidence available at the time, that Mr. Al-Awlaki was a lawful target because he was participating in the war with Al-Qaeda and also because he was a specific threat to the country, unquote. And I should add that these same two attorneys had problems with the way the Bush administration carried out their extra constitutional tactics, but seemed to have no problem with Obama doing even worse. Now, look at the insane justifications they use. And again, I'm reading from the article, quote, while the Constitution generally requires judicial process before the government may kill an American, the Supreme Court has held that in some contexts, like when the police, in order to protect innocent bystanders, ram a car to stop a high-speed chase, no prior permission from a judge is necessary. The lawyers concluded that the wartime threat posed by Mr. Al-Awlaki qualified as such a context, and so his constitutional rights did not bar the government from killing him without a trial, unquote. Well, by that logic, Al-Awlaki would have to be posing an imminent threat. In other words, they would have to catch Al-Awlaki while in the process of carrying out an attack, perhaps having some explosives strapped to his person while en route to a U.S. target, and let's say a plane or automobile. That's just one example. The point being that the article gives no evidence that Al-Awlaki posed an imminent danger, but was rather just a rabble-rouser that the U.S. wanted to shut up. Now, what does Ray McGovern make of these so-called legal justifications and the lawyers who came up with them?
Well, I call them triple M's. Magnificently malleable mafia lawyers.
Okay. That's perfect. I love that.
This high-speed chase is laughable.
Yeah.
What parallel is there? Give me a break. They're as bad as John Yoo and Jay Bybee, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if you go down one more paragraph here, this is truly extraordinary. In an attempt by the New York Times and the government, the 36 people who talked to these guys, okay,
right,
who were authorized to do this, I'm sure, what comes through here is not only that they began drafting this meticulous memo, comprehensive memo, quote, expanding and refining their legal analysis, but in an unusual step, researching and citing dense thickets of intelligence reports supporting the premise that Mr. Al-Awlaki was plotting attacks. Whoa, wait a second. We got a bunch of lawyers reaching into dense thickets of intelligence reports supporting the premise. Oh, there's a revealing phrase. So the premise is that Mr. Al-Awlaki was plotting these attacks, and so find me all the intelligence reports that say that.
Yeah.
This reminds me of how before Iraq, Wolfowitz and Cheney, they beat on the intelligence analysts. The ombudsman for the CIA said he had never seen such a hammering on intelligence analysts to serve up a thick, dense thicket of intelligence reports supporting the premise that Al-Qaeda had something to do with Saddam Hussein. And as you and I know, at this time, exactly 10 years ago, 69% of the American people were sold on the notion that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
There it's Leni Riefenstahl. There are the propagandists par excellence. And here's the New York Times, the newspaper of record, going into with a straight face saying, not only were these lawyers, so meticulous looking through the law, but they went and fished out intelligence. Who gave them those intelligence reports? John Brennan.
Right.
A little further for all the ones that said Al-Awlaki. So that's the major thing. And the thing that I would emphasize is right in the first, so second paragraph here, Al-Awlaki is described this way. He had evolved, and I quote, from a peddler of internet hatred to a senior operative in Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? End quote. There's no alleged. There's no reported. And how many people read the New York Times article of this length? They read the first two paragraphs, and what they bring away from this is, oh, of course we kill them. He had evolved from a peddler of internet hatred to a senior operative in Al-Qaeda. That's the question. That is. And then the whole thing is, you know, sort of two predator drones got their lasers on him, and then two Reapers took aim, and they fired, and he was killed because of painstaking intelligence work. Give me a break.
Reading over this New York Times piece, the authors never really address any hardcore evidence that would link Mr. Al-Awlaki with any terrorist activity. The best they can do is link him with this so-called underwear bomber, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, based on a supposed confession he gave during interrogation with FBI agents. Now, reading from the article, quote, in his initial 50-minute interrogation on December 25th, 2009, before he stopped speaking for a month, Mr. Abdulmutallab said he had been sent by a terrorist named Abu Tarek, although intelligence agencies quickly found indications that Mr. al-Awlaki was probably involved. When Mr. Abdulmutallab resumed cooperating with interrogators in late January, an official said he admitted that Abu Turek was al-Awlaki. With the Nigerian statements, American officials had witness confirmation that Mr. al-Awlaki was clearly a direct plotter, no longer just a dangerous propagandist, unquote. Now, notice that the authors rely on an anonymous official as a source for equating Abu Turek with al-Awlaki. We don't know if this is actually true, and even if Abdulmutallab did say this, it's hearsay that al-Awlaki can no longer challenge. Also, if Abdulmutallab did in fact confess that the two were one and the same, under what conditions did he make this confession? Was he subjected to enhanced interrogation? Was he persuaded to make this connection in exchange for a plea bargain that would avoid him facing the death penalty? What does Mr. McGovern make of all this?
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I'm looking at this paragraph here. In the initial 50-minute interrogation, he said he was sent by a terrorist named Abu Turek.
Mm-hmm. al-Awlaki?
Yeah. And so, how'd they find out? Well, one official said later,
during the plea bargain, no doubt,
Abu Turek, that was really al-Awlaki, right, yeah.
Right.
And, you know, if you look at al-Awlaki, okay? Now, al-Awlaki was a decent Muslim cleric.
Mm-hmm.
He preached in Falls Church, not far from where I live in Arlington, okay?
Mm-hmm.
After 9/11, he went and preached at the Capitol in Washington. He was attended big prayer breakfast with Pentagon brass, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's right after 9/11, okay? So, all of a sudden, something changed him, okay? Now, when Brennan was asked, what changed Abdulmutallab, he said, well, you become self-radicalized. This is the danger. These people can self-radicalize themselves, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, applying that criterion here, what's changed al-Awlaki? Well, if you look at what happened, immediately after 9/11, at least 1,000 Muslims were rounded up in New York and New Jersey, thrown into these jails, with the jailers told that these guys were responsible for what happened on 9/11. They were tortured. Not one of them was kept on any tenable ground. They were all released, some as long as 8 or 9 months later, okay? Well, you're al-Awlaki, you know, you're watching this, and then there's an invasion of a country that had nothing to do with 9/11, okay? Not only Afghanistan, little to do, but Iraq, nothing at all to do. So, what changed al-Awlaki? I would have us believe that al-Awlaki and other terrorists are hardwired at birth to hate the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he really, then he said that to Helen Thomas, he said that during the Abdulmutallab expose as to why he almost succeeded. He said that they're hardwired, that they're just born that way. They hate us. Yeah, but why? They just hate us. It's the most remarkable interview ever. She kept pressing, and he would never say why. Either he doesn't know why, which makes him dumber than I could imagine, or he just, you know, he just sort of is caught up in this thing. We've got to go after these people. We've got to drone them to death. We've got to kill 4,700 of them and teach them a lesson so there'll be no more terrorists, even though 2% are terrorists. And he doesn't realize? He doesn't realize that every one of those 4,700 people killed by drones have extended families, which forever and ever will hate the United States with a passion. He doesn't realize that it's just a matter of time before some Pakistani, like that fellow in Times Square, comes back from Pakistan. It was Pakistan that radicalized them, not al-Awlaki, okay?
Mm-hmm.
His folks lived in that northwest frontier area, and they experienced it directly. He visited, he talked with them, came back and decided, what is al-Awlaki? Sure, maybe he was in contact with al-Awlaki, but it was the experience. It's what we're doing, okay?
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I resort to my simplistic, but I think very telling simile here, or metaphor, I guess it is. You know, the way you stop terrorism is the same way you stop malaria, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, with malaria, you find the mosquitoes, and you track them back to the swamp in which they breed. And then what do? Well, you set up three platoons of sharpshooters, and you try to hit them as they leave the swamp, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wrong! You drain the swamp!
Correct.
In this case, the swamp was the legitimate grievances. All those people who live under people like the Saudis, who live in the West Bank, Gaza, who live in places in Pakistan, where you can't even go outside, you can't even go to a wedding or a funeral without risk of being killed. Those are the legitimate grievances. And unless you drain that swamp, those mosquitoes, those terrorists, are going to just multiply and multiply, and it's just a matter of time before our country will be faced with a major terrorist incident, and then there'll be some rejoicing by the people who want to limit our civil liberties even more than they've already been limited, and you'll find that the Draconian regime imposed on us, not unlike that Hitler imposed in the 30s in Germany, and American people, ignorant as they are because of the mass media, will say, well, if that's the price we have to pay, we'll just succumb here, and hopefully these people will keep us safe from terrorists.
Yeah, one of those heart-wrenching stories I read about drone attacks occurred in Pakistan a couple years ago, I guess, where the drones came in and supposedly got their alleged target and then came back against the rescuers and the people who went to aid people at a funeral for this guy that was killed, and killed 10 children and 60 other civilians. I mean, just imagine how much contempt was bred just from that single action there at this funeral. Those people, and like you say, their extended families, and it's any wonder that we have this kind of blowback. I mean, I'm surprised there isn't more blowback. You know, these people are actually quite reserved. I mean, if something happened to my family, I can only imagine what kind of retaliation I would have. But you know, it's not
only the funerals. You know, it's been established by people in Pakistan, that's where the CIA is running the drones,
mm-hmm.
that not only do funerals and weddings, you know, they're susceptible to these attacks because there are more than five or seven people, and some of them may have a camera that looks like a weapon. But it's the people going to aid, it's the people whose families are blown up.
Mm-hmm.
They hesitate now for hours on end to go to see if there are any survivors for fear of what they call second attacks, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, reports that drone operators in the United States, in Langley, Virginia, or out there in Nevada, are having a lot of serious psychological problems. They're reinforcing the chaplain corps, and they're wondering why it is. You know, here it's so antiseptic. Well, how would you feel? You're a young sergeant in the U.S. Air Force, okay? When you push these buttons, and you realize that it was your pushing of this button that killed all those people at a funeral or trying to help other people. Now, you know, I think it's a healthy sign that these people are having real pangs of conscience. I think it's a healthy sign that chaplains are brought in to minister to these people. I just truly wonder what these chaplains tell them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. What do they say? That it's okay, and you're doing God's work? Is that... Oh, man.
Yeah, it's a high-speed chase. Oh, look at the line. Yeah, high-speed chase. Give me...
Right.
You know,
what a cowardly thing to do, sitting in an air-conditioned booth, sitting there like a video game, watching these images, and, there's got to be a culture that is growing up in this generation which has been raised on these video games where they are really being trained to kill. I know there was a lieutenant colonel from West Point by the name of Grossman who wrote a series of articles on the effects that video games have on children, how we're creating these people. We're creating sociopaths. We're creating psychopaths who really have no empathy, and they have no innate ability, or that one part of your brain in the forebrain that keeps you, that prevents you from wanting to kill another human being, is being calloused over, where they're being able to just do this automatic firing. But yeah, this culture of violence, I think, is a sad commentary on the United States. But one thing I wanted to ask you too. You know, I was surprised, to be quite honest with you, in the wake of the supposed killing of Osama bin Laden. Well, after that boogeyman had been removed from the consciousness of the American people, I was thinking that they were going to get a lot of mileage out of this al-Awlaki, as if he would be the new face of terror. But then they end up killing him shortly after that. What is the reason? Why was it necessary, in the opinion of Mr. Ray McGovern, why did they have to get rid of al-Awlaki? Why was it so... I was surprised that they did it, to be quite honest with you.
Well, John Brennan is at the root of all this. I know the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what he's become. And just as I related way back before Senator Barack Obama became president, Brennan insinuated himself into Obama's confidence and persuaded him, for example, to vote for holding the AT&T and Verizon companies innocent for their violation of the FISA law and the Fourth Amendment. And on this, he's got some sort of a bloodlust, okay? He knows these guys in this area. He's on first-term terms with Saleh, who used to be the head of Yemen. He was chief of station in Saudi Arabia. And so he proposes to Obama, who apparently is not really very well-versed in foreign affairs like this, and he says, look, we can get this guy al-Awlaki. It'll be a real big propaganda thing for you because, we can accuse him of being responsible for things like Abdulmutallab and not our policies, the swamp analogy again.
Yeah.
And we can get him. And let me think about it. Let me talk to the Saudis, my old friends. And guess what they do? They set up a base, a U.S. Air Force base, or CIA base, you call it, doesn't matter, in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the background here? Well, we know Osama bin Laden's major motives in doing 9/11 was because of the U.S. occupation of the country of holy sites that are revered by all Muslims in Saudi Arabia. Now they got another. They're going to keep it secret. Well, for God's sake, you can't keep anything like that secret. All you need is a Google map, for God's sake.
Yeah.
They don't care about keeping it secret. So what happened? That's where those guys took off from, as is explained in this very artfully crafted article. And that's where two predators had laser identified them, and then two reapers came and reacted, and he was dead, Well, that's a big thing. Now, the only problem was that whatever kind of constitutional lawyer you think Obama is, he must remember the Fifth Amendment, He must remember that no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. And so he's a little inhibited. And so what did he say in the beginning? He said, well, he was just killed, And it was great, great expertise on the part of intelligence people and people he was killed. He didn't say we killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until years later, 18 months later, that anybody, our servile press,
mm-hmm.
the president completely accepted, and our, bought Congress,
mm-hmm.
not until Brennan becomes up for CIA director, anybody thinks to ask the question, and they didn't really care much about foreigners, you could kill them. Well, how about an American citizen? Well, we had these lawyers work on that, these magnificently malleable mafia lawyers, They weren't John Yoo, gee, Bybee, he's a judge now. John Yoo, he's a professor of law. Now, these were two new guys who thought that Bybee and Yoo were not good, but they were good, and now they go back to academe, having this legacy behind them. Yeah, it's really, really atrocious what's going on here.
Uh-huh.
And so we end up with the Brennan being not held to account by these suborned congressional leaders, Dianne Feinstein. I mean, the way she looked at the guy. If you saw those hearings, yeah, she said, now, Mr. Brennan, weren't these terrorists in touch with Al-Awlaki before they did these bad things?
Yeah.
And Jeffrey said, yes, they were.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, he says, yes. And she says, well, can you tell us how? No, I'm sorry, I prefer not to do that. The secret.
National security, right.
It's really a comedy of, it's really not funny, but there you have it.
And, yeah.
So, you know, when you have Al-Awlaki as a prime candidate for killing, and he's an American citizen, you know, I think back to the biblical days when, you know, the Apostle Paul, you know, they're going to bring up charges in one of these rinky-dink places within the Roman Empire. And what does he say? He says, what's the word? He says, I am a Roman citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what they do?
Mm-hmm.
They shiver and they quiver and they go, oh, God, that means you have the right to due process. And what they do? They said, you have the right to go to Rome. So they send him to Rome, where he has some sort of due process, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it used to mean something when you said, I am an American citizen, okay? Civitas Romanus sum. That's what it is. I am an American. I am a Roman citizen. Civitas Americanus sum doesn't mean diddly. Doesn't mean diddly.
Mm-hmm.
If some smart lawyers say that you can be killed without charge, without court, without jury, and who's the Lord High Executioner? Well, we know. John Brennan goes into the Oval Office on Tuesdays. He's got this legal pad with, let's say, I'm not there anymore. I used to brief, okay, but I'm not there anymore. But I can just see a legal page here. Mr. President, we have 13 suspected militants here that we're going to extradite. We're going to kill this week. And Obama looks at the list. He goes, all we need is your initial visa. Yeah, but number three, with that strange name there. John, didn't you tell me last week that he has three small kids? Oh, yes, Mr. President, but we've seen him have lunch with other suspected militants. We're sure he's a suspected militant, so we put him back on the list. Well, John, look, do me a favor. Take him off. Well, let's talk about him next week. Let's just go move the 4, 5, and 6 up. We'll just do a dozen this week. Okay, here's the signature. Now I need to go off to have lunch with Michelle.
Right.
Give me a break, you know? That's just like...
Just give me your signature right here, Mr. President. Don't read it.
I just need your initials.
Yeah.
Sort of like a rental contract on a rental car.
Right.
Initials.
Yeah.
And so he goes... Now, this reminds me of Lisa Rice. Back in 2004, okay? She's orchestrating demonstrations of torture techniques in the basement of the White House. And who's there? The Attorney General, the Defense Secretary, Colin Powell of the State Department, Richard Clark.
An all-star cast.
They're all there, okay?
Yeah.
Who comes in to demonstrate these things? The experts on enhanced interrogation techniques, Chef de Fenemo, in Gestapo handbook terms. And they should. Now, and what happens? Ashcroft is quoted walking out of one of these meetings, and he says, Do you think we should really be doing this in the White House? Well, that was bad enough, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now we have a very antiseptic process where Brennan gets the names from various and sundry, puts them on a legal-sized pad, brings them to Obama. He says, just your initial here before you have lunch. And he, well, just in my putative example here, he says, well, I see one here, three small kids. Yeah, three. Oh, let's... We'll do that next week. You know? It is atrocious. It is far from what our founders wanted, and
mm-hmm.
they put it on Constitution so carefully. And since I live now, originally from New York, but since I've lived for the last 50 years in Virginia, You know, I feel not only a particular pride in being identified in some distant way with people like James Madison and George Mason, who crafted our Constitution, and I've become aware of things like the fact that after the Constitution was crafted and was just about to be voted on, George Mason, who lives just a couple of miles down from where my house is, he says to James Madison, Jim, I don't know how to break this to you, but I can't sign this.
Mm-hmm.
Madison says, George, you're kidding. I mean, you crafted most of it. What do you mean you can't? Jim, it doesn't have a Bill of Rights. I can't, in good conscience, sign it. Now, if you promise me, as the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, you will, as president, when you become president, you will fight very, very hard for this Bill of Rights, then I'll keep quiet about this. I just won't say anything. And Madison said, it's a deal, George, you keep your mouth shut, and I'll see to it that we get this thing, these 10 amendments. And for the next 4 or 5 years, up and down the Eastern Seaboard, rode these folks in horses, getting the approval of the various states, and it was. It became part of the Bill of Rights. So James Madison is not only the only one responsible here, it's George Mason. And George Mason made those guarantees for our liberty. And we see people playing fast and loose with the First Amendment, freedom of assembly, Fourth Amendment, freedom from unwarranted searches, the Fifth Amendment, freedom of life, for God's sake. Well, you know, that's really serious. And once again, I did not say this frivolously or in jest. I say this to all people who swore, as I did, a solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the fact that that has no expiration date, what is it that we are compelled to do in conscience to follow the example of the George Masons and the James Madisons who guaranteed our freedom for lo these many years? The question we need to pose to all people who consider the Constitution sacrosanct.
All right, well, you heard it here first, folks. That was former CIA analyst and anti-war activist Ray McGovern. Please visit his website, raymcgovern.com. That's RayMcGovern.com, where you will find a great deal of information on the various intrigues of this corrupt, usurping entity known as the federal government, particularly as it relates to our foreign policy. I also want to take this opportunity to encourage those of you out there listening to subscribe to American Free Press for a small fee. You not only get the articles that appear here on the website of AmericanFreePress.net, but also a whole lot more from our staff of cutting-edge writers in a real honest-to-goodness newspaper that you can keep and share for years to come. Thanks so much for tuning in, folks. Until next time, this is Keith Johnson, signing out.